Risky Business. Risky Business. Risky Business.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this special edition of Risky Business. I am Patrick Gray. This week's show is a bit of a special edition, coming to you from the World Trade Center in Rotterdam in the Netherlands. I'm here at the GovCert Security Conference, where I've just done my own talk about social and mainstream media manipulation techniques. That was fun. And I've had a chance to catch up with a bunch of very clever people who you'll be hearing from in coming weeks. This week's show is hosted by Vigabyte Virtual Hosting, but brought to you by Checkpoint Software. If you've worked in enterprise security for any length of time, you already know Checkpoint. And later on in the show, the company's engineering services manager, Steve McDonald, will be along to have a talk about a recent report. It was one that we mentioned on last week's show, and that was the report that claimed up to 9% of corporate machines are actually infected with custom design malware. Working for Checkpoint, Steve has a lot of exposure to large corporate clients, and depressingly, he says the report is entirely plausible. And that interview is coming up later. Now, this isn't a regular edition of the show, because I'm travelling, so sadly we will not be joined by our regular news guest, Adam Boileau, for the weekly news segment. Instead, we'll be having a chat with NeoHapsa CTO Greg Shipley, who's also here in Rotterdam, doing his own talk at GovCert. Greg's firm actually did the forensics work on one of the organisations allegedly compromised by Alberto Gonzalez, the internet supervillain. If you've been in a cave for the last few months, you may not have heard that Gonzalez is the guy who's suspected of stealing up to 135 million credit card numbers over the last several years, and now he's in prison as a result. Anyway, Greg's talk here at GovCert in the Netherlands looked at how these sorts of breaches can actually happen in an organisation or organisations that pay attention to security. They have their vulnerability scanning, they have their PCI compliance stuff, they have penetration testing. So I spoke to him yesterday about this concept, and here's what he had to say.
Yeah, I was talking about a few concepts, the biggest ones being just assumptions around control technologies that we use and a lot of organizations use, and the assumptions around how effective they are. And what kind of got me down this path, I mean, it's certainly an idea that I've been thinking about for a long time, but what really drove this home was the recent breach reports and the subsequent arrest of Gonzalez, who was is accused of allegedly breaking into a veritable who's who of U.S.-based corporations.
And didn't he plead guilty? I don't think we have to say allegedly anymore.
Yeah, he pled guilty on at least one case. I don't know about the other ones.
Ah.
Is my belief that this is the guy and his cohorts? Yes, most likely. But, you know, I'm going to let the legal system take its follow its process. But regardless, he allegedly broke into these corporations and stole well over 100 million credit cards. And, you know, this really got me thinking. I mean, it's one thing when you have kind of ma and pa restaurants and bakeries and small stores and, you know, small e-commerce sites getting popped and having data stolen. But it's quite another when you have, you know, these are major corporations that basically these guys blew through them like Swiss cheese. And if you read the formal filings against them, it's fairly clear that, you know, this wasn't a 24-hour affair either. I mean, these guys went in pretty deep and took a lot of stuff. So, you know, as a practitioner and as someone who's been in this industry for a while, you see that type of stuff, and there's part of me that wants to celebrate and say, wow, you know, we actually caught a bad guy, right? But then there's part of me that's like, my goodness, are we actually effective at what we're doing if, like, three guys can blow through all these controls that these organizations had? I mean, I'm sure if you went and looked at these organizations, it wasn't like they didn't have firewalls or didn't have antivirus technology or didn't do vulnerability scanning or any of the things that we kind of rely on. So so my talk was a lot about key assumptions around various technical controls we use, like how effective are vulnerability scanners and how effective is antivirus technology. And you know, I've been dogging on antivirus technology for some time, and you and I...
And on our show. Yeah, that's right.
You and I have certainly talked about it. One of my concerns, though, is you know, how do we assume that it's going to catch 80% of the stuff, 30%, 20%? You know, what do we assume it's going to catch, and how do we bake that into our models? And as a company that has done a lot of forensics on some pretty big cases, oftentimes the servers that are compromised absolutely have antivirus technology on them.
Now, I should point out, you actually did handle, your firm did actually handle some of the forensics work for one of the Gonzalez victims. Is that correct?
Yes, it is, and I certainly can't go into the details of which one, but, you know, we are familiar with at least one of those cases. And in not only that situation, but many other situations, I mean, these organizations are running antivirus technology. They're running it on their systems, yet there's malware, Trojans, keyloggers, and all this stuff sitting there undetected. Now, okay, so, you know, to any practitioners out there, they're going to think, well, no duh, you know, this isn't a big shocker. But one of the things that I'm starting to realize is when you go out of the IT security circles is that there's a lot of both IT executives and business executives that assume if my organization was successful in a PCI audit and I'm, you know, doing the firewall and I'm doing the antivirus, then I'm okay. And these are base assumptions. So what I'm trying to do is actually promote some more thinking about this, some more thinking about the assumptions we make about these technologies and how effective they are, as well as I've really been talking a lot more about promoting something I call the IT risk register. And, you know, risk registers are certainly nothing new, but I found that in the IT world, they're not used. And this is one tool that I think a lot of security professionals can use to start conveying things upwards to management, not only IT management, but hopefully executive management above them, to convey potential risks that could come and bite them in the butt later on.
Well, it's funny you say that, because we were chatting yesterday, weren't we? And you said, you know, you don't even think that 7-Eleven had, or, you know, some of the companies that got hit by Gonzalez et al. Actually had get owned, get all your customers' credit card data stolen, get thoroughly penetrated for like 2 years. Like that right. Just wasn't even a worry for them, was it?
Right. And so, you know, and that started, that whole conversation started with a colleague of mine that was asking, was presenting the question, when all these organizations, at least in the U.S., there was a group of organizations that were announced that were related to Gonzalez, and then some more trickled out, you know. And so the joke amongst a lot of the people in the industry was, well, who did this guy not hit? And so as this was coming out, one of my colleagues raised the question of, hey, when do we start seeing CEO and CIO heads roll as a result of these breaches?
Hang on, just before you continue, I mean, that said, this comes back to the whole ineffectiveness of the technology thing, right? Now, when you've got this heavily customized malware that's being used to scrape transactions out of back-end systems, you can't expect AV to get that, because they're not even collecting samples of this sort of stuff. So, you know, it's one thing to say, okay, heads should roll over this stuff, but what are they expected to do? What can they actually do, Greg?
Yeah, and that's okay, so I'll get to that. Bear with me here. So, you know, so my colleague raises this question. I say, you know, it's a good question. But, you know, one of the things I ask is, did they even know? Did they know how much risk that they were currently operating under? And if they didn't know, why didn't they know? And what it occurs to me that when you start talking at CEO levels, CEOs know what questions to ask in all sorts of business contexts, right? And I'll take an example of our own industry, professional services in our own business. Our CEO and our board of directors knows there's a set of key questions to kind of determine company health. You know, there's obviously all the financial questions. There's things like utilization, billability goals and levels, average deal sizes, accounts receivable, aging summaries. I mean, there's these questions that they use. They're kind of baseline metrics to kind of measure the company's health. And it occurred to me that I don't think we have that set of questions for IT security.
So, do you have a PCI audit? Yep, I've ticked the box.
But that's exactly it, that's the assumption, right? Yeah. The assumption is if I have this myriad of technologies, vulnerability assessment and IDS and firewalls and antivirus, that, and I got this PCI audit, of course. You know,
so I think I see where you're going with this, which is if this stuff actually finds its way onto the risk registers and it goes up to management, management's going to go, holy shit, this isn't good enough, and then we might actually start seeing some action.
That is my belief. My belief is if it's conveyed in terms that management can understand, the organization is at least at that point given a choice. We accept this risk, or we need to put in a compensating control to mitigate it, right? But at least at that time, at that point, you're having the discussion. And what I think happens right now is I don't think upper management knows what questions to ask, and I think us in the trenches don't know how to convey that stuff back up in a meaningful way that is going to convey risk to management. So I think a big piece of this, at the risk of sounding overly cliche here, is we have to get better with risk management, and we have to get better with conveying that. And I think the introduction and use of IT risk registers is a critical first step in that.
Can you take us inside your involvement with that that Gonzalez victim at all? I mean, what sort of how sophisticated was this guy and his team? Are we talking about serious freak show customized malware that was incredibly advanced, or did they actually get in using all of the dumb tricks that we've all known about for years, but no one seems to bother fixing? I mean, how much of an evil genius was this guy? I guess is what I'm curious about.
The answer would be somewhere in between. Right. So I'll throw this back.
So if there was dumb stuff, he used it, but he could also use the more diabolical stuff.
Yeah. But there's varying levels of sophistication, obviously. You know, there's folks that are going to use just straight available pen testing suites, you know, Metasploit being, you know, a very common one. But there's commercial, there's tons of exploit engines, right?
That click to own.
Right. There's tons of that. Then there's, and I'm not going to say that propose that SQL injection attacks are necessarily rocket science right now, but to be able to leverage some of those, you've got to be a little bit better than point and click using an automated exploitation tool. And then once you get into these organizations, there's, you know, how do you do data mining? How do you find the right servers? You know, what kind of Trojans, batch uploading mechanisms, keyloggers do you use? And there's also
all the exfiltration stuff as well, which is a whole other headache
right.
for an attacker.
But what I think the whole community is slowly waking up to is that the models that we have used in the past with the disgruntled teenager that's sitting in his basement and hacking for fun with his friends, well, those guys are still out there. We're talking criminal gangs now with serious money, right? And so, okay, so everyone knows, okay, yeah, the criminals are in it, cyber fraud, everyone's kind of up to date on that. But I don't think we've started asking the next questions, which is, how funded are they? You know, what can $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 buy you in terms of vulnerability information, exploit code, Trojan kits? You know, how hard is it to actually fabricate Trojan kits that aren't going to be detected by modern AV? And things like a $20,000 or a $40,000 U.S. investment weren't things that we discussed even a couple years ago. But that's money that's trivial to these guys now.
Well, that's interesting that you say that, because there's a pen tester I know who says, give me $100,000 and I can own anyone. And you know, pen testers, as we know, love to spout off stuff like that. But these days, I tend to believe him.
Yeah. Now, so I've had a conversation with a few folks about black hat budgeting, right? And you know, one of $100,000, I think would be, I think that's a little on the light side. I think it's probably more than that. But I would say it would be more than that and less than $1 million. Right?
So it would be less than the IT security budget of that organization.
Well, you know, what's interesting is there's a gentleman I know, Richard from GE, and you can Google his blog. I think he's the first one who started talking about black hat budgeting. At least he's the first one that I knew of. And he raised a really good issue. I mean, I started putting together a budget for what I think it would take. And in fact, that was one of the slides that I presented on. You know, how much would you do for R&D? How much would you do for travel, equipment, server leasing costs, bandwidth?
Cigars, beer.
Sure. The miscellaneous fund, you know, spare change fund. But you put this budget together, and what I was proposing that it would be somewhere between $200,000 and $800,000 U.S., right? And for that, you could name a handful of targets, and probably I would say you have a good chance of success in 12 months or less in pretty much any Global 2000. So What becomes a very interesting question, though, after that, so $200,000 to $800,000 U.S. range, is how much does $200,000 to $800,000 get you on the defensive side? And in a large organization, not much. in really large organizations, it won't even cover your desktop antivirus expenditures. So it presents a pretty tough scenario for those fighting this battle. And so that's a big piece of what I was trying to convey in my talk yesterday, was we need to start thinking about this, and we also need to start thinking about, besides adversarial profiling, the recognition that we're probably only going to be able to defend a certain amount of assets, digital assets. And I think one of the things that we as a community have to get better at is figuring out what are the top five that we can't lose. So in these companies that lost tons of credit card information, I'm guessing that those credit card numbers were in that top five. That was one of the top five things that couldn't be compromised, yet they were compromised.
Well, this is interesting. I mean, credit cards clearly were never designed to be used on the internet. They came along from a pre-internet age, and all of a sudden it's like, well, you just give someone this 16-digit number, and they can bill you, and it's really convenient. And all of a sudden we're doing it on the internet. Bad idea from day one, and here we are. So, you know, there's an argument going around that says, I mean, even Bruce Schneier was here talking about this yesterday, and I, to an extent, agree with what he was saying, which is that you do not have to authenticate the user. You need to authenticate the transaction. Now, if we can actually build ourselves a very robust way of authenticating the people who are trying to use certain credentials to do certain actions are who they say they are, then we don't really need to worry about the security of their data anymore. I mean, what do you think about that?
Yes and no. I mean, I agree with the concept of authenticating the transaction, but you know I get a little confused there because I'm not sure how you authenticate the transaction without authenticating
the individual
doing
the
transaction. So that's a whole other discussion, and we can have that one. But taking a step back and not just talking about credit cards, because obviously credit cards aren't the only thing at risk right now.
Well, that's the extension, which is the, you know, things like the formula for Coke or whatever, which is another, you know, trade secret sort of thing. But the thing is, credit card fraud is making so much money for the bad guys at the moment that it's funding their R&D. It's their bread and butter money. So I think if we can clean that up, then we've struck a pretty big blow. But yeah, tangent, but
yeah.
Continue.
And you know, just looking at the U.S., I mean, I think we need to work on that, and maybe there is a new system that needs to come up. And there are some interesting there have been some organizations that have made headway. For example, Bank of America, you can go on, and if you're a Bank of America credit card holder, you can get a one-time credit card number that is tied to a specific merchant for just online purchases.
Right? Ooh, that's cool.
It is cool, right? So I can say, all right, you know, I am only using this credit card number. It only exists for my use on eBay, and that's it. You know, or that's a bad example, but Amazon or whatever, right? So we are making slow progress there. But one of the things that is a big problem, at least in the United States, is changing underlying infrastructure is not a trivial issue. You know, you and I had discussed just the other night the whole chip and PIN thing in Europe. You know, and why does Europe have chip and PIN and the U.S. doesn't? Well, the big thing is merchants don't want to absorb that cost, right? So we got to retrofit a whole lot of merchants in the United States, and it just hasn't happened. And that's going to take a while. I mean, one, we have to have the political and financial will to do it.
Or a bunch of Romanians coming in and skimming the absolute f*** out of you guys for a couple of years. That should do it. That's what happened to us.
Yeah, we already have that going on, you know. All of a sudden
the retrofit starts looking cheap, you know.
Yeah, well, and maybe we're getting to that pain threshold. But it's, you know, obviously we're not there yet. In any event, regardless, and part of the problem with InfoSec is I think too much of the conversation often does revolve just around the financial services, and that they're usually the early adopters of new security technology. Yeah. They're usually the first ones to get hit.
But even if we clear up all those problems, it's still not going to protect the formula for Coca-Cola, which
right.
I think is the point you're making.
Well, whatever business or organization, whether you're supporting the business's goals or the mission of the agency, whatever agency or bureau or whatever you work for, there are in most organizations a set of critical business processes or a set of critical data sets that need protecting. And they're the most sensitive and they're the most critical. And we don't like to think about that. And in fact, in a lot of the IT industry, folks aren't even fully aware of what those critical processes are. So a lot of the things that I see that IT organizations struggle with are doing that mapping of that critical process or that critical data set to all of the assets and infrastructure it touches. And some IT organizations have that completely mapped out. They know that this critical business process touches this set of sensitive data and it exists across these networks and these systems and that SAN and whatever. They've got that mapped out. But a lot of organizations don't. And because they don't, they also don't have the ability to segment or monitor or put additional controls on those limited resources. And I think until we start doing that, we're just going to continue to be ineffective.
I mean, one of the things that I see changing is actually people like you talking about this stuff now. I mean, you started off as a penetration tester, and now here we are talking about enterprise risk registers. Do you think that's going to be something that will really help? The problem is that the young tackers who grew up defacing websites are now in large corporations thinking more like corporate people?
The honest answer is I'm not sure. I think a part of the problem is technical and part of it isn't. Part of it's organization, political, communication, that type of stuff. And I think...
But we seem to be addressing the latter more and more these days and not just looking at it as a technical problem.
I think we're getting better. But to loop this back to my earlier point, until the CEO knows what questions he needs to ask the CIO to have some level of assurance that his most sensitive digital assets are secure, we still have a problem.
NeoHapsa CTO Greg Shipley there with a look at how contemporary IT security controls are failing us. Up next, it's time for this week's sponsor interview with Checkpoint's Steve McDonald. Steve is Checkpoint's engineering services manager, and in his job, he spends a lot of time with some pretty large and heavy-hitting clients. So when a company called Dambala, recently claimed it had research suggesting 9% of corporate systems have been infected with malware, I thought I'd get Steve on the line to see if it sounded plausible to him. The malware Dambala alleges has infected all of these machines isn't your garden variety stuff. It's targeted at industry verticals or even specific companies. This is a topic that dovetails really nicely, actually, with the previous conversation we've just had with Greg, because we're talking about, you know, malware that just generally isn't detected. So I spoke to Steve before I left for the Netherlands, and here's what he had to say.
Look, I'm not sure about the 9% as a figure, but we've had real experiences with customers talking about this. As to how crafted it was, I haven't really seen specific detail, but we're talking about very targeted inbound attempts at propagation via email as a path, and people really having situations where custom code is passed through web proxies and wasn't detected.
Yeah, well, that's sort of meshes with what these guys were saying, is that it's not so much your big botnets that are infecting corporates, but custom designed stuff designed to infect individual organizations or even particular industry verticals. Is that what you've found?
Well, as I said before, we've seen customers who have undergone or appear to have undergone very targeted attacks. So that would mesh with what I'm hearing out there speaking with customers. But at the end of the day, there is some real money behind this. So there would be every reason to think this is going on.
Mm-hmm. So how do you actually wind up, you know, well, how do these customers that you're speaking about wind up even discovering that they've got a problem? If this is the sort of stuff that isn't picked up by signatures and actually gets through all of your perimeter protections, how do you even know?
I guess it's going to come down to having a good awareness of what's going on in your environment, but normally you're going to stumble across it because you have a PC-related issue, maybe some code's not written as well as it should be, and it trips over itself. But there's no reason to suspect that in some instances, there's every reason to suspect that in some instances people are not simply aware because they don't have enough visibility of what's actually going on endpoints.
Yeah, I mean, what do you think the solution is here? I mean, you guys are very well known for making perimeter defense, but is it really that case of embracing that concept that we call deperimeterization, which is instead of actually having that hard shell on the outside and the GUI center on the inside, do you think organizations really need to be spending a lot more time and effort on stuff like internal IDS, like IDS on the LAN, just to get better visibility?
Yeah, it comes down to the evolution of network security. You know, we grew our massive perimeters and we added more firewalls there and kind of ignored the inside, the nice soft center. That's kind of a denial phase. Then we decided to increase the number of firewalls and then throw some video cameras in there as well with IDS, which people wanted to turn into protection mode but never actually could. And then everybody realized that that costs too much to run, so they started virtualizing it. And that's where we're at the moment, where we've got all of this firewall infrastructure and IDS infrastructure in place. We're reducing the cost of it all, but I don't know how much extra security a lot of customers are realizing because of the complexity of managing these things.
What about host intrusion detection? I mean, I suppose when you're talking about heavily customized malware that looks like a legitimate application or a legitimate process, that's still not really going to do you much good.
Yeah, look, there are technologies out there where we can absolutely lock down an endpoint or a workstation to the point of what applications can run, what DLLs can be called. But very few customers have got an appetite to actually get to that level of security policy enforcement on end users. It's just too risky. You put your workforce out, that's going to cost you a significant amount of money. So they're balancing a risk there, or maybe not even aware of the risk, really.
Yeah, I was having an interesting chat with a guy I know who's a chief security officer about what could be a good solution. Is everyone, you know, you hear these AV guys talking about how whitelisting isn't really that practical because most large software companies rebuild their applications like every other day. So you've got version 3.627-B, you know, slash smiley face, right? So he was saying, you know, if you've got an SOE, it would be good if you could actually manage that process yourself, distribute, you know, MD5s, I guess, via Active Directory or whatever. That could be a good solution. Do you reckon that there's room in the market for solutions like that, which allow you to do process control and really lock down your SOE and allow you to manage it instead of relying on external, you know, AV providers or whatever to give you your whitelist?
Yeah, look, you're going to have to excuse the plug here, but that's exactly one of the functions of our endpoint security suite. And there are other vendors out in the market doing the same thing. So it's not Active Directory based. It's more self-contained in a security layer because we don't think that embedding that within the Microsoft environment would probably yield the right outcomes for people. Mm. So this is more around the security layer of management, provisioning out full disk encryption, full endpoint security, VPN connectivity, and auditing across the top of that. But really, we're talking about controlling what applications, what versions they are. We have the ability to do checksum-based authentication of those applications. But then got to step it back a bit, and we're talking about this ever-moving perimeter that's moving inwards a lot. And, you know, 1994, maybe people had two security projects that were going on that they were securing their network with AV and firewall, probably. Now we're looking at 12 to 14 projects for most customers to regularly be looking at, whether it be lifecycle maintenance of some old stuff or some new items. And the ability to get to that level of depth in anything is getting really, really hard for customers. Endpoint is something that is on everybody's agenda, but there's so many other things they need to worry about, from IPS through other malware protection. Data leakage is obviously a hot topic, and it kind of all blends together. But once again, it's really difficult to manage all of these disparate systems.
I mean, it still is the case, though, isn't it, that once you get a foothold on someone's LAN by taking over a workstation, it's pretty much a party from there on in, isn't it? I mean, still, even now in 2009, there you go.
Yeah, look, I did my first network segmentation consulting piece in about 2003, and at that point it was deemed impossible in any large organization to segment even the data center from the user population, let alone getting any level of segmentation beyond that. 2009 rolls around, I don't know if we're really any closer to being able to do that. And it's just simply trying to define the policy for a large-scale network where we're trying to segment, you know, big chunks of it up. Very difficult. You're going to require a massive amount of people, technology, expertise, external consulting, just to even start doing it. And the risk is you break the entire network.
Box A can't talk to box B sort of thing.
Yeah, and then we start going, well, do we treat the user networks as external networks and just move to a remote access style situation?
What, like, you know, Citrix style stuff or VMware virtual desktop infrastructure?
Yeah, that's right. But then we see another problem where the data center perimeter is actually heading inwards and imploding as well, where we're seeing more virtualization, more density of processing and applications. So now we start seeing, you know, virtual firewalls operating in the hypervisor layer. And that once again changes the game. And then as we start looking at cloud-based computing, the technology may not exist in the data center. It may be somewhere else entirely. Mm. So it's a very moving objective at the moment.
So, yeah, it used to be, you know, segmenting your network, and now you've got to worry about segmenting your VM. So you're sort of doing the same thing, but just in one location.
That's right. And really, it's a bit of a monster that needs some form of containment, but I can certainly appreciate there's some challenges.
Yeah, so I mean, what do you think needs to happen to deliver us a workable sort of deperimeterization solution where we actually have well-segmented, hardened endpoints with a lockdown SOE that's easy to manage? I mean, is this just a case of vendors catching up to customers' needs and being able to offer easy turnkey, you know, I hate to use that word, it's a bit of a wank, but yeah, turnkey solutions that just make it a bit easier? And do you think vendors have actually been able to deliver that, or are we still playing catch-up?
I think it comes down to people, first of all, identifying they have a risk or a problem out there. You know, we don't have any mandatory disclosure laws in Australia for corporates if they lose customer data. These kind of things often are the driving force behind security policy implementation capability. So until we really see some changes there, the board does a security view of this or a risk committee reporting into a board. You know, they don't get much funding for things like this at the moment. There's enough money to do what people have been doing, but to go to the next step, that's, you know, going to require a fair bit of funding. But second to that, there's a few different views about how we get there and what role infrastructure plays in this and what role some form of services-oriented architecture plays in this and how that links into endpoint security and network access control. But you are right, these things need to be tied together. And I think both customers and vendors are striving to try and get to a place where we can do that properly.
So you reckon perhaps the problem really is that the customers don't have the big stick hovering over their head, which is forcing them to seek out these solutions, and thus the vendors have little motivation to actually develop them?
Well, I think the solutions are in the market, whether they're as comprehensive as we might like them to be and at the price point that's required for the market. But you know, you look at laptop encryption. Every single laptop in this country that contains sensitive data should be encrypted. You know, we don't even know the stats of what the reality is, and when we know they're quite low in terms of percentages. But then also, you know, we've got all these disparate solutions of IDS and firewalls and all the traditional security technologies. Trying to then add to that extra layers and do some form of centralized top-level management, that's really going to be the key to doing this in an affordable way for customers so they can provide the security they need without breaking the bank.
So really, I guess what we're striving for is a world, say, in 2 or 3 years from now, when I get you on the phone and say a company has done some research and found that there's 9%, you know, 9% of corporate machines are infected, and you just laugh it off and say, well, that's clearly not true. I mean, that's what we're aiming for, isn't it?
No question about that at all. But once again, it's going to be interesting in a couple of years' time to say, what is a corporate laptop and what does the network look like and what have we done to secure it? Did we just push the problem off to somebody else? Did we simply, you know, long line, you know, move things into cloud computing and give up on it? Do we ask people to bring their own laptops into the home and provide their own security and we do some form of perimeter enforcement on them? There's going to be a different place in 2 years, there's no question.
Checkpoint's Engineering Services Manager Steve McDonald there with a look at targeted botnets and their penetration into corporate networks. And that's it for this week's show. I'll be putting up another special edition next week, which will most likely feature a speech by David Rice, which is quite a lot of fun. Because I'm travelling through Europe and it's just a little bit hard to do the full-time edit, you know, three interview, whole all singing, all dancing, risky business. But we'll be back. When do I get back? I get back on the 17th of October. So we'll be back to regular programming after that. But until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.